that recent message we studied, the one on 1 John called Christians and Antichrists, it just really forces you to look at the world right now, doesn't it?
It really does. It was so grounded in prophecy, but it felt incredibly immediate.
Exactly. And the sources gave such a necessary balance to it all.
They did. You know, even as we're dealing with the real practical things, praying for Joe Nestlescan, for the Cox family, organizing donations for Operation Christmas Child, the message just kept reminding us that our walk is about leaving right now, but with a clear understanding of what's coming.
That blend of present ministry and future certainty, that's exactly what we need to get into today. So for this deep dive, our mission is really to take that material from 1 John and also 2 Thessalonians and just clarify this whole concept of the Antichrist.
Right, to kind of separate the present Antichrist attitude from that specific future man of lawlessness.
And then pull out the key reminders for how we're supposed to live in what the sources call a pretty dark world.
Well, let's start with the word itself, because the Greek, antitos, it has this dual meaning that is just so important to understanding John's warning.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It means both someone against Christ and at the same time, someone who puts himself in the place of Christ.
So you have this outright opposition on one hand, but then this subtle, deceptive imitation on the other.
It's not just about politics, then. It's really about a person's fundamental position toward Jesus Christ.
That's the key. Are you for him and his truth, or are you operating against him, or maybe even instead of him, whether you're open about it or not?
Which leads right into that idea of the last hour. We hear that phrase a lot. How do the sources actually define it?
Well, they're pretty clear that it's not a countdown on a clock. It's the present evil age itself, this whole period.
The whole period. Since when?
It likely began when Jesus announced his messiahship, or maybe when he ascended. But it's this entire age where Antichrist forces, and notice that's plural, are actively working against Jesus.
Ah, okay. So Antichrist in the plural versus the Antichrist in the singular. That's a huge distinction.
It is. The forces of Antichrist are absolutely alive today. The sources describe it as a kind of sway, a spirit that holds people.
So any non-believer, anyone who denies Christ,
is an antichrist in their attitude and action. But at the same time, the Bible points to one single person, the man of lawlessness, who will show up at the very end of the end of days.
And the sources pointed out how terrifyingly fast that spirit works. They said the Antichrist force formed so quickly that they crucified Jesus within just 3 years of him announcing he was the Messiah.
It just shows the intense, focused hatred that has really defined this entire age. It's a spiritual operation.
Okay, so let's pivot to that singular figure, the one who comes at the end. The material really focused on Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians for this.
It did, and he was writing to calm some very real anxiety. The Thessalonians were in distress.
They were being heavily persecuted, and they thought
what?
That they had missed the rapture.
Basically, yeah, they thought they'd missed it and were now stuck in the day of the Lord facing God's judgment. They were terrified.
So Paul's letter was a reassurance. He's saying, hold on, you haven't missed anything because these final events can't happen until two other things happen first.
Exactly. That's the anchor he gives them. The day of the Lord, which is God's wrath on a rebellious world, cannot come until, one, the falling away, the apostasy happens.
And two, the man of sin, the son of perdition, is revealed.
Right. And for their peace of mind, it's so important to see the difference there. The rapture is the church's hope, Christ gathering his people. The day of the Lord is the judgment that follows. Paul is saying you can't be in the judgment because the guy who kicks it all off hasn't even shown up yet.
That makes the structure so much clearer. And Paul uses these incredibly powerful titles for him. Man of sin, man of lawlessness, anomia, and son of perdition.
And he makes it clear that this isn't just some clever politician. His coming is, and this is a quote, according to the working of Satan with all power, sign, and lying wonders.
A satanically manufactured leader.
That's a good way to put it. The culmination of all human rebellion empowered by Satan himself.
So before we get deeper into the man, let's go back to that first condition, the apostasy. What does apostasia specifically mean?
The Greek term means rebellion, a revolt against God. The sources call it a deliberate abandonment of a formally professed position. It's a defection.
And the teaching made a distinction between the general defection we see now and the apostasy Paul is talking about.
A vital distinction. General defection is, you know, the heartbreaking trend of people leaving churches or having a shallow faith that just crumbles under pressure.
And the statistics the sources mentioned were, they were pretty sobering. The estimate of 100 churches closing every week in America.
It's a sad picture, for sure. It proves that spirit of Antichrist is active. But Paul was talking about something far more dramatic. The apostasy isn't a slow drift.
It's an event.
An identifiable, unique event led by this man of lawlessness. An organized, prophetic rejection of God.
And the climax of that rejection is just the ultimate act of self-worship, right? In 2 Thessalonians 2.4.
Precisely. He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. It's the moment it all becomes physical, this absolute blasphemy.
So let's talk about his destiny then, that title, Son of Perdition. What does perdition tell us?
It's a strong Hebraism, son of perdition or son of destruction. It's a way of saying he is literally doomed for destruction. Ruin is baked into his spiritual DNA.
And the sources connect him directly to Judas Iscariot.
He's the only other person in the entire Bible called the son of perdition. And that link is profound because both are controlled by Satan. Satan entered Judas, and Satan gives the Antichrist his power.
So he's destined for destruction from the very beginning.
From the moment he steps on stage. And the Thessalonians, who knew their Old Testament, they would have recognized him from a prophecy in Zechariah.
The worthless shepherd.
Yes. And that image is just terrifying because it's the exact opposite of the good shepherd. Zechariah describes a shepherd who slaughters the sheep, who has no care for the weak or the broken. He's a fraud.
And God's judgment on him is so specific. A sword shall be against his arm and against his right eye. What's the symbolism there?
The arm represents his strength, his power to get things done. The right eye is his intelligence, his wisdom, his foresight.
And God says, he'll destroy both.
Completely. His arm will wither and his eye will be totally blind. So even though this man will be the greatest genius the world has ever seen, God guarantees the destruction of his wisdom and his power.
Wow. That's a sobering thought about worldly genius.
It is. So how does this figure, this doomed shepherd, deceive the entire world?
Well, his rise is deceptive. The sources are clear. He isn't just an archetype like Nero or Hitler. He's a specific man, probably from the Middle East.
And he starts out as a peacemaker. During the first 3.5 years of the tribulation, he's the solution. Revelation says he conquers without a sword. Daniel says he signs a protective treaty with Israel.
He looks like a hero.
The hero the world has been waiting for. But that peace is just the setup for the turning point, the abomination of desolation.
The one Jesus warned about in Matthew 24.
That's the moment. He walks into the Naos, the inner sanctuary of a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem, and he performs this act of self-deification. He demands worship, and he's got the false prophet there backing him up.
And Jesus' command for that specific moment is the most urgent one in the whole prophecy.
It is. It's a command to run, flee to the mountains, don't even go back in the house for a coat.
Why so urgent?
Because the moment he sits down in that temple, his tolerance ends. That's when the Great Tribulation begins, a time of massive persecution and massacre right alongside God's final judgment.
It's a profound and terrifying picture.
Yeah.
But the message brought it all back to our responsibility today.
Mm.
So as we wrap this up, what is the core takeaway for us right now?
I think it's twofold. Awareness and focus. We have to be aware that these Antichrist forces are active, trying to substitute Christ's truth with self-worship. But we also have to stay focused, knowing that the prophecies guarantee God is sovereign and he controls the end.
And that focus is what fights the anxiety, isn't it? I thought it was so powerful how the teaching brought in that November memory verse, Philippians 4.6.
It's the perfect anchor. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer. Let your requests be made known to God. That prayerful posture, that's our defense against the fear of these times.
It is. You know, I talk about how God's judgment on that worthless shepherd is the destruction of his strength and, crucially, his intelligence.
He has wisdom.
This final Antichrist will be intellectually superior, brilliantly persuasive, yet his end is the complete ruin of his power and his mind.
It really forces you to ask a question, doesn't it?
What's that?
In a world that is so impressed by human genius, by political power, by persuasive speech, where are we placing our trust? What does it mean for you today to actively rely on God's wisdom, on scripture, instead of getting captivated by the clever but doomed wisdom of the world?
That distinction, that's where our safety is.